Well, it is wonderful to see everybody here this morning. Please open your Bibles to Mark chapter 6. And if you've got a bookmarker, please place it in Mark chapter 6 as we're going to be, and you're going to be scared by what I'm about to say. We're going to look at Mark chapter 6, 7, and 8, and a little of John 6 while we're at it. The title of our lesson is Back and Forth Across Galilee. And the reason I picked that title is because as you study the ministry of Jesus, what you realize is that he did a lot of traveling. And sometimes that traveling can seem kind of random. You wonder, well, why did he go there at this time? Why did he go back to this area at a different time? Why does he avoid Jerusalem during this time of year? And why does he spend so much time around Galilee? As you look at Mark 6, 7, and 8, that becomes abundantly clear. He crisscrossed Galilee constantly. He was going across the sea from one side to the other. He was going up to Tyre and Sidon at one point. He crossed back over the sea to Decapolis, to a primarily Gentile region. And again, you wonder, as you're studying this, why is he crisscrossing Galilee the way that he is? Let's begin in Mark chapter 8 and notice the end of our story. One of my favorite devices in storytelling, by the way, whether it's reading a book or watching a movie, one of my favorite devices in storytelling is when a story starts at the end, and it kind of gives you the ending, and you're left going like, well, how did we get to this point? And I want to do that with you this morning. We're going to start at the end in Mark chapter 8 and begin in verse 14, and follow along with me if you will. And they had forgotten to take bread. They did not have more than one loaf in the boat with them. Now he was giving orders to them, saying in verse 15, watch out and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began to discuss with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this in verse 17, said to them, why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet see? Do you not yet understand? Do you have a hardened heart? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you pick up? And they said to him, 12. And in verse 20, and when I broke the seven for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of broken pieces did you pick up then? And they said to him, 7. And he was saying to them, do you not yet understand? Do you not yet understand? So as we look at the end of our story, we're left asking a number of very challenging questions, which we'll address as we work our way through the text. First of all, what's the significance of the fact that they had no bread with them in the boat? They just might have had one small loaf off to the side, but not enough bread for their needs at the moment. What about the leaven of the Pharisees? What does Jesus mean there? Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. At what point in Mark 6, 7, and 8 should they have learned any lessons from the leaven of the Pharisees? Another question. Why does Jesus constantly use bread throughout this context? As we read Mark 6, 7, and 8, and as we look at John 6 briefly, you'll notice that bread seems to be a theme in everything Jesus says and in every pit stop he makes on this crazy, circuitous, back-and-forth journey they're about to take across Galilee. Is there some kind of a lesson or some kind of a connection that the disciples were supposed to have made at this point on bread? And why is Jesus so insistent that they ought to have understood something by now? Several times in Mark 8, Jesus says, don't you get it yet? Don't you understand? So in this lesson, we're going to try and get to the bottom of this. What should they have understood at this point? What lesson was Jesus trying to get them to understand? Obviously, he believed they could have understood it. Obviously, he believed they should have understood something. So what did they experience in the previous days and perhaps even weeks that Jesus expected them to take note of? Let's go back to the beginning of the story then and notice a few things about Galilee. If you're not familiar with Galilee, I'll give you basically your five-minute primer here on the Sea of Galilee and the district in which it was. The Sea of Galilee was named after the district of Galilee. It had fresh, sweet water and abundant fish. And I think that's something you could clearly see from the text in the Gospels, is there were a number of people in the Gospels that made their living from fishing in the Sea of Galilee. Most of the communities along the shoreline of this very, very large lake actually were based almost entirely on the fishing economy. Interesting thing is the lake sits below sea level, so the shoreline is actually only a very, very thin strip. You almost have the sea, a very thin strip of shore, and then cliff faces, high hills that surround the lake. Most of Jesus' ministry took place around Galilee. His home was in a town called Capernaum, along with most of his disciples, though Bethsaida and Capernaum were almost like twin cities near the north of the Sea of Galilee, and so they tended to go back and forth between those cities quite a bit. Just so you're aware, the northern and western shores of the Sea of Galilee were primarily made up of Jewish communities. So as Jesus is in Capernaum and Bethsaida and Tiberias and other places, he's speaking to a mostly Jewish audience. But when you cross the Sea of Galilee and go to the southern and the eastern shores, it's a primarily Gentile audience that Jesus is going to be speaking to. And I point that out because that fact becomes quite significant when you see the different stories and the things that he says as he crisscrosses back and forth across the sea from the Jewish side to the Gentile side of the sea. The story here begins somewhere on the Jewish side of the Sea of Galilee. Please go back to Mark 6 and notice around verse 32, Jesus is looking for a lonely place to pray. He wants somewhere where he can pray, somewhere that he can rest in verse 32. But he can't escape the crowds. And in verse 33 of Mark 6, it says, "And the people saw them going, and many recognized them, and they ran there together on foot from all the cities and got there ahead of them." Verse 34. "So when he went ashore, he saw a great multitude, and he felt compassion for them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things." And what a beautiful scene this is, isn't it? All Jesus wants at the moment is a little peace and privacy, an opportunity to pray and to recuperate from all the things that he had done in the previous weeks. Now, I think a lot of us, when we want our recuperation time, we tend to not let anything get in the way of that. We'll block everything else out, turn off the TV, or maybe turn the TV on if that's what gives us relaxation. We'll block everything else out and just take 5 minutes to be selfish. Does Jesus take even 5 minutes to be selfish here, though? No. Rather than resenting the multitudes for finding him in his quiet place, he feels compassion for them, and he wants to teach them. Because when you're Jesus Christ, the Son of God, you do not waste an opportunity to present the gospel to willing ears. As Mark chapter 6 and John chapter 6 both explain, Jesus feels compassion for the multitudes and commands his disciples to provide food for them. Now, what's his disciples' response? They look at the thousands of people that are gathered around, and they look at the provisions that they have with them, basically lint in their pockets, and they say, "Jesus, we don't have enough here to feed this many people. And if we send them away, where are they going to find food in this barren and desolate place?" And Jesus tells them, "You're going to find food for them. You will feed them." Notice here, beginning in verse 35, "This place is desolate," his disciples tell him, "and it is already quite late. Send them away," they say in verse 36, "so that they may go in the surrounding countryside and the villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered and said, "You give them something to eat. Shall we go and spend 200 denarii on bread and give them something to eat?" they say. So he asked them in verse 38, "How many loaves do you have? Go look." I like the way Mark's gospel puts that. "How many loaves do you have? Go look." Don't just give me like an easy answer. Don't just dismiss it and say, "Well, we don't have enough." No, he says, "You go look. I want a definite answer. You tell me how many loaves you have." So they found out. They said, "Five and two fish." And he commanded them all to recline by groups on the green grass. And in verse 40, they reclined in companies of hundreds and of fifties. And he took the five loaves and the two fish, and in looking upward to heaven, he blessed the food and broke the loaves And he kept giving them to his disciples to set before them. And he divided up the two fish among them all, and they all ate and were satisfied. So don't dismiss this as non-miraculous. It's not just that he took that small amount of food and divided it up into such a small amount that 5,000 people could eat, each just a morsel. No. That many people ate and were satisfied. They ate and were satisfied to the point that they even had leftovers afterward. They picked up in verse 43, 12 full baskets of the broken pieces and also of the fish. And there were 5,000 men who ate. Take special note of the number of baskets of leftovers. It's 12. Don't make any conclusions yet. Hold on. Just log that piece of information away in your mind. 12 full baskets on this side of the Galilee. Now, let's work our way a little bit forward through the story. He then commands his disciples to head in the direction of Capernaum in Bethsaida. But they encounter a storm along the way. We know this story very, very well. They witness Jesus calm the storm miraculously. And they end up landing in Gennesaret. Notice in Mark 6 and verse 53. When they had crossed over, they came to a land called Gennesaret and moored to the shore. And when they had come out of the boat, immediately the people recognized him and ran about the whole country and began to carry about on their pallets those who were sick to the place they heard he was. And wherever he entered villages or cities or the countryside, they were laying the sick in the marketplaces and entreating him that they might just touch the fringe of his cloak. And as many as touched it were being cured. So between these villages here in Capernaum and in Gennesaret, there's all these small communities, little enclaves of people, and they're coming to him from every corner of that part of the Galilee to be healed. Now again, this is a primarily Jewish audience. We need to understand that. These are heavily Jewish communities coming out to a Jewish rabbi, or at least they would so understand him to be a Jewish rabbi, and they're being healed miraculously. What a wonderful time. What an exciting time for the people on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. But not everybody's excited. It's during this time period of healing and miracles that we find out in Mark chapter 7 that not everybody was on board with the ministry of Jesus. The Pharisees come to him in Mark chapter 7. What's the big problem that they have? What's their big issue that they take with him in Mark chapter 7? How come your disciples don't wash their hands before they eat their bread? Now, we're not just talking about that in the sense of just cleanliness. Wash your hands before you eat dinner. We tell Sterling that all the time because who knows where those hands have been all day long. We're talking ritual cleansing here. It would have been very, very common for the Pharisees and those who were like-minded to wash their hands, not because they were worried about germs. They were not really aware of germs as we understand them today. They weren't washing to have clean hands because of the germs. They were washing because of the Gentile cooties. That's really all it was. They were washing their hands because they had Gentile cooties all over them. Because every time they go out in the marketplaces and interact with Gentiles, anytime they touch something, just be outside their homes, just to make sure that they got all the Gentile off of them, they'd ritually wash their hands. So the Pharisees' big issue is, how come your disciples don't wash their hands the way that we do? How come they're not washing their hands the way that they are expected to? Because of, according to verse 3 of Mark 7, because of the traditions of the elders. It's an interesting conversation that Jesus then has with them. Obviously, bread is a component of it, isn't it? They don't wash their hands before they partake of the bread. But notice what Jesus says in verse 6. Rightly did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far away from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men. Neglecting the commandment of God, you hold to the traditions of men. Now remember the end of our story in Mark 8. Jesus talks about beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. Maybe we're starting to get a piece of that puzzle now, aren't we? That by the end of the story in Mark 8, Jesus is reminding them, we've gone on a long journey together, and at different points we've encountered the Pharisees. You've smelled the leaven of the Pharisees, haven't you? You've smelled the yeast of the Pharisees wafting through the air. You know what it smells like. You know what it does to people. The leaven of the Pharisees kills true religion. The leaven of the Pharisees kills decency and compassion. The leaven of the Pharisees keeps your eyes off of the prize of the kingdom of God. It distracts you with the traditions of men. And it replaces the commandments of God with the expectations of other people placed upon you artificially. We're getting a piece of the puzzle here, aren't we? But that's not all. While we're here in Gennesaret, Jesus also makes one thing abundantly clear. Pick up in verse 18, please, of Mark 7. Are you so lacking in understanding? Do you not yet understand that whatever goes into the man from outside cannot defile him? Because it does not go into his heart, but into his stomach and is eliminated. And look what Mark includes here parenthetically. Thus he declared all foods clean. There's food again. We got bread and fish in chapter 6. We got washing your hands before you eat in Mark chapter 7. And now here's Jesus going out of his way to talk to his disciples about declaring all foods clean. Surely he's not just talking about food, is he? We need another piece to this puzzle, don't we? Let's take stock of some things up to this point. You don't have to stare at the Sea of Galilee for a couple minutes here. But we're going back to the map. It's hard to ignore the role of bread in these stories, isn't it? The multitude lacked bread. Jesus provided bread for them. His disciples got to handle the bread that he provided. I know that's a fact that shouldn't be ignored. That as Jesus was miraculously providing bread, he wasn't the one handing it out to everybody. Who was doing the handing out? Who was passing out? It was his disciples, wasn't it? They got to handle the bread that Jesus was creating for them miraculously. Everybody was satisfied by the bread. So satisfied that they even had leftovers at the end of the meal. When you go to John chapter 6, John chapter 6 is the parallel account. This is the same story, understand. This is Mark chapter 6, but this is another piece of it that Mark doesn't include in his account. In John chapter 6, notice, beginning in verse 26, the multitudes find him in that Mark 6, verse 53, through the end of the chapter area where he's doing miracles between Capernaum and Gennesaret. In that time period, the multitudes find him and they're asking for more bread. In verse 26, Jesus said, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you seek me, not because you saw signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled." That's why you're here. You're interested in me because of the food, the bread. There's bread again. Boy, that bread sure features prominently in this story, doesn't it? But look at verse 27. "Do not work for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man shall give to you, for on him, the Father, even God, has set his seal." After this, in John chapter 6, they end up having this long, drawn-out conversation about the bread of life. And Jesus says, "I'm the bread of life." I don't know. The multitudes aren't crazy about that. They're not crazy about that introduction of possible cannibalism into their religion. That's how they interpret it, of course. And Jesus pushes it and pushes it and pushes it. He says, "I'm the bread of life. You have to eat my flesh and drink my blood if you want to be a part of the kingdom." Now, by the end of John chapter 6, we understand that he's talking spiritually. Jesus himself even says, "It's not the flesh that profits. That's not what I'm talking about. It's the spirit that profits you." So in this whole conversation about bread and miraculous bread and eating the bread and the bread of life and washing your hands before you partake of bread, and in all this conversation about bread, are we really just talking about bread? Or is Jesus expecting his listeners and now his readers 2,000 years later to see that there's a deeper lesson behind the bread? The Pharisees, according to Mark 7, wanted the bread on their own terms. Yes, they would eat the bread, but they wanted to wash their hands first. They wanted to have their traditions first. They wanted to have their man-made laws before they partook of the bread. Yes, we'll eat the bread, But we're going to follow the traditions of the elders first before we partake of the bread. That's asking for God's bread on your own terms. And in Mark 7, verse 19, like I already alluded to, Jesus declared all foods clean. There's a lot of bread in these chapters, isn't there? That's the great thing about reading large swaths of the Bible. This is a little side note for you, a little practical application for you in your Bible study. Sometimes when we're reading like daily Bible plans, which are great, I don't have a problem with them at all, but we tend to read things very, very isolated. We'll read one chapter here, and then tomorrow you'll read another chapter, and then tomorrow you'll read another chapter. You know what I really like in my Bible study? Give yourself like a whole hour. Don't just take 15 minutes or read little bits in here and a verse out of context. Give yourself a whole chapter sometimes. Or a whole hour and just say, I'm just going to read. I'm just going to read. And try to get as bird's eye view as you can on the text. Because when you do that, you realize when you read Mark 6, 7, and 8, you're going, bread, 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 bread. And Jesus says in Mark 8, do you get it yet? Do you get it yet? Well, let's go back to Galilee. Seemingly out of the blue, Jesus takes his disciples on a field trip to Tyre. It's very interesting, isn't it? He's in Galilee, he's talking about bread, he's confronting the Pharisees, they're having all these great conversations about bread this and bread that, and just out of the blue he says, we're going to go to Tyre today. Okay? So he picks up in Mark chapter 7 and verse 24, and they head to Tyre. And who do they meet there in Tyre? By the way, Tyre and Sidon, primarily Jewish or primarily Gentile? Gentile. Yeah, we're talking about a Gentile community here going to Tyre and Sidon. Who does he meet in Tyre along the way in Mark chapter 7, verses 24 through 30? He meets a Gentile woman, a Syrophoenician. Her daughter needs to be healed by Jesus, and she begs Jesus. She pleads with Jesus, will you heal my daughter? What do you think they talk about? What's the point of their conversation? It's bread. Jesus looks at this woman and he says, no, it's not right to give bread to the dogs begging at the dinner table. Now, understand, Jesus isn't trying to be insulting to this woman either. He's not trying to be insulting. I think he's making a play on words with her. She knows she's a Gentile. She knows he's a Jew. There is an understanding between a Gentile woman and a Jewish man. There is an understanding that the overall prevailing social context is the Jew thinks the Gentile woman is a dog. And I think Jesus is kind of making a play on words. They're like, almost like a wink, wink at her. Like, you know I'm a Jewish man. And I know you're a Gentile woman. And you know what I'm supposed to think about you. I'm supposed to think you're a dog. So what are you doing talking to me, begging for bread from a Jewish man, when I'm supposed to see you as a dog? What a clever response she is. Great faith, isn't it? Most people might have gotten discouraged and given up and walked away like, wow, Jesus is just a typical Jew, just a typical racist, insulting Jew who only sees me for my race. That's all. No, she insists. Even the dogs get to partake of the crumbs that fall from the table. Are we still talking about bread here? Yeah, there's bread again. And what does he do for her? He heals her daughter. He goes all the way to Tyre. And this is not a small journey here. We're talking 20 or 30 miles, depending on, it doesn't say the city of Tyre, it says the region of Tyre. So it depends on where we're talking about. We're talking 20 or 30 miles on foot, seemingly out of the blue, we're going to go to Tyre. We're going to walk 30 miles to Tyre, and I'm going to heal a Gentile woman while we're there. And then when I'm done with that, we're going to walk back home. Very out of the blue, isn't it? What a strange event to just kind of randomly throw in there. And as if that's not strange enough, it's not just that they go home. He has them go all the way from Tyre to the northwest, and he has them cross the Galilee Sea to the southeast and go to Decapolis. And in Mark chapter 7, beginning in verse 31, they get to Decapolis. And what does Jesus do there in Decapolis? He finds a man who's deaf and has very, very difficult time speaking. What does he do? He heals the man. in Decapolis. Well, what's the big deal about Decapolis? Let's talk about Decapolis. What's the significance of Decapolis? Why is Jesus going all the way from Tyre, all the way down to... We're talking, you walked 20 or 30 miles to get to Tyre, and now you're going to walk well over 20 or 30 miles to go back all the way to Decapolis? You're crossing the sea? This is a very strange series of events that probably has his disciples kind of stroking their beards going, why exactly are we going to Decapolis right now? Why and why are you healing Gentiles in Decapolis? So what's kind of the significance? The disciples already had reasons to be wary of Decapolis, didn't they? They'd already been there. If you read back in Mark chapter 5, they've already been to Decapolis. And what happened there? Well, who's the first person who meets them in Decapolis in Mark 5? A man with a whole lot of demons. What's the next thing they see? A herd of pigs. Let's see. On my first trip to Decapolis, I saw a demon-possessed man and a lot of pigs. As a good Orthodox Jew, that's not exactly where I'm going to be taking my summer vacations. Understand that Decapolis was everything that it meant to be heathenish and Hellenistic. Decapolis was kind of this loose affiliation of about 10 cities on the other side of the Galilee. These cities were semi-autonomous, and they were heavily Hellenistic. Hellenistic means Greek. Very, very Greek cities. And in these cities was just about every form of debauchery that would shock any Jewish grandmother. It's believed, actually, that in Luke 15, in the story, the parable of the prodigal son, that when he goes away to his faraway land, it's believed by most that Decapolis is the faraway land that he goes to. Because what does he have to do for a living while he's there? He has to tend pigs. What do you find in Decapolis in Mark chapter 5? Pigs. Basically, that's the worst place that you want to go if you're a good traditional Jew. This is a land full of heathenish Greeks who eat pork. And here's Jesus dragging his disciples from Tyre all the way to Decapolis, a place where they've already encountered everything that it means to be disgusting and Gentile. And what does he do with them in Mark chapter 8? Shockingly enough, about 4,000 men gather around. 4,000 men, that does not include the women and the children. About a crowd of 4,000 gathers around Jesus. And he offers them the same miraculous bread and fish meal that he does to the Jews back in chapter 6. You wonder sometimes as you're reading the Bible, why does Jesus feed a crowd of several thousand twice? I've heard that from people. Is this just a retelling of the same story? Is it a misinterpretation? Is it that Jesus didn't think that he was being affected the first time around? Why do we have basically the same story twice? The answer is it's not the same story. Yeah, he feeds a crowd of several thousand with a minuscule amount of bread and fish. And at the end of it, when everybody has eaten and is satisfied, there's a lot of leftovers. But what's the key difference between Mark 6 and Mark 8? The difference between the side of the Sea of Galilee. When you're crossing from a primarily Jewish audience to a primarily Gentile audience, and you are offering the same miraculous bread to two different audiences, how shocking would that have been to the disciples? What is the amount that is left over? How many baskets? 7. You're starting to think in your head, Ryan's going somewhere with this, isn't he? There's one more sea crossing that they make as we bring our story to a close. Jesus takes his disciples to Bethsaida while discussing the events of the past few days. And that's our original text in Mark chapter 8. It's our original text. So we've come full circle now. We started at the end and went all the way back to the beginning, and now we've crisscrossed the Sea of Galilee several times. We've gone all the way to Tyre. We've gone all the way to Decapolis, and now we're going back to home turf. We're on a boat in Mark 8 and verse 14. We're on a boat headed back to home turf, the comfort zone, Bethsaida, the twin city of their hometown. And on their way back to Bethsaida, this is where he asks them these questions that we originally considered at the beginning of our lesson. How many baskets were left over the first time we did this? And they said 12. How many baskets were left over the second time we did this? And they said 7. And he says, do you get it yet? Do you get it yet? Where have we been on this journey? Where have we been over the last several days or possibly weeks? Remember, all of this is on foot. We're talking dozens of miles on foot. It's conceivable that Mark chapter 6, 7, and 8 have taken up to a month of their lives to complete. And they were expected to learn something. They were expected to remember something. On the Jewish side of the Sea of Galilee, there were 12 baskets left over. What does 12 generally represent in Hebrew symbolism? Well, you've got 12 patriarchs, 12 sons of Israel. You have the 12 stones on the ephod of the priest. You have the 12 tribes of Israel. 12 is Israel's number. 12 is Israel's number. What does 7 generally represent in Hebrew symbolism? Now, I'm not saying every time. Sometimes a 12 is just a 12, and sometimes a 7 is just a 7. I'm not saying every single number is symbolic, but what does 7 generally represent? It's a complete number, a total number, especially in terms of cycles. You have 12 baskets on the Jewish side. You have 7 baskets on the Gentile side, and the same miraculous bread being offered to both of them. And to drive his point home, Jesus takes him on this long on-foot journey to Tyre to heal who? A Gentile. And takes him all the way to Decapolis to do what? To heal a Gentile. And all along the way, like Mark 7 says, he declared foods clean. Again, are we talking about food anymore? Did he declare food clean? Or did he declare people clean? Jesus says, do you get it yet? Do you get it yet? So as we bring our lesson to a close, I want to ask you the same question that Jesus, do you not yet understand? Do you not yet understand that some lessons take great time and patience to learn? Jesus literally had his disciples hiking for miles over many days just so he could prove a point. Weren't there people in Galilee who needed to be healed? Couldn't he have healed somebody in Capernaum? Couldn't he have found somebody in Nazareth to heal? Why does he take them all the way to Tyre? Why does he take them all the way to Decapolis? Because he's going out of his way to prove a point to them. Do you not yet understand that sometimes the lessons that God wants us to learn in life take a long time to come to fruition? Sometimes, like Abram, like we studied in Bible class this morning in Genesis 15, sometimes we have to accept the promise of God before we have any evidence to believe that it will come true. Romans 4 says he looked at his body as good as dead. He was 100 years old and unable to have children. And yet God told him he would have a child. Did that promise come true? Yes. But it took a long time. Some of the promises of God take a long time and a lot of effort for us to finally see the way that they have come true. Do you not yet understand that we can never allow the leaven of the Pharisees into our lives? We must never let the pettiness, the small religion, the favoritism, and the false piety of the Pharisees to blind us to the spiritual needs of those around us. Do you realize that this whole time that Jesus is ministering to the Pharisees, do you realize that this whole time that the Pharisees have been sitting on that side of the Galilee, that the Jews have been comfortable in their own communities, on their own side of the lake, that just a few miles across the water, there was a world of people who needed to hear about God? There was a world of Gentiles out there, desperate for truth. The Pharisees had no intention of going across the Galilee to them. The Pharisees had no intention of reaching out to the Gentiles. They didn't care about Gentiles. They spent too much time washing their hands of the Gentiles, distancing themselves from them. And here's Jesus saying, guys, it's time to cross the Galilee. It's time to go to the land of demons and pigs and reach out to the people who want to hear truth. It is time to offer them the same bread of life that was offered to the Jews, Remember what Romans chapter 1, verse 16 says. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. Do you not yet understand that we are the beneficiaries of God's marvelous gift of bread? Like the heathens from Decapolis or the woman from Tyre, we receive the bread of salvation freely from the hand of our Maker. And it does not matter where you've come from. It does not matter where you were born. It doesn't matter what your race or your ethnicity is. It doesn't matter what your economic standing is in the eyes of other people. Jesus crossed the Sea of Galilee to the Gentiles so that the door could be opened up for us to hear the gospel as well. When the gospel was offered to Gentiles, it was offered to you and me. Jesus is the bread of life, according to John 6. We're not talking about just bread anymore, though Jesus uses the bread as a symbol in all of these stories to drive the point home to his disciples. It's time for you to leave your comfort zone and start spreading the bread around. Do you not yet understand that you have an obligation this day to become a Christian, to heed the words of God and to obey the commands that He's given us through His wonderful and blessed gospel? He who believes and is baptized shall be saved, according to Mark 16, verse 16. That's how you can partake of the bread this very day. Why won't you obey? Well, together we stand and sing.